Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which, together with the Science and Technology Forum, the Business and Leadership Forum, and the Environmental and Natural Resources Forum, organized tonight's event. That's the first we have ever had four forums cooperate, because the topic is a fascinating one, of a combination of science and the combination with business. So I'll give a few announcements first before we get to Dr. Hamet's lecture. First, I'd like to welcome new members to the Commonwealth Club, and we assume that you will get a very good use of your membership. I'd also like to welcome our online and radio audiences that might be listening a little bit later, and our audience here in San Francisco. The Humanities Forum puts on about 30 to 40 events a year here at the club, and I'll tell you about a couple of them that are coming up. We have a series called Monday Night Philosophy, which we do on the second Monday of every month, and we are covering politics this fall. I don't know why. It just seems to be a good idea to us. And so on Monday, September 10th, which is next Monday, we have Diane Dwyer, the NBC anchor, and Randy Shandoval, who retired not too long ago after 30 years at KTCU or KTVU, the other Channel 2 station, here as the political correspondent and interviewer of most of the top politicians. And they're going to be speaking on the media and presidential politics. There's been a lot of talk about, that we're a red-blue country and we're a 50-50 nation. But if you look at the details carefully, you'll see, and I think it was very clear in this primary season, but even clearer the last time, that a lot of it is media-generated, because the media is very interested in the race being as close as possible. Because the closer the race is, the more advertising, of course, that needs to be done. So we have a couple of anchors here to talk about that possibility. I don't know if you noticed, but I mean, when Hillary Clinton, for example, was way in the lead, then they were supporting Obama. This was back in 2008. As soon as he passed up Hillary, they started finding good reasons to support Hillary. So they kept that race going the whole time. And this time, with Mitt Romney's primary season, obviously the party that's out, they kept looking for somebody to be the one that went against him. Every week or every 2 weeks, there'd be somebody new. Because the better the race is, the more money is spent, obviously. That's only one of the many issues that are involved. But that's one of them. And then next month, October 8th, we have Patrick Iber, a fellow at Stanford University, speaking on what is the purpose of democracy. To go a little bit more deeply into, we think we're so democratic. How democratic really are we? We're going around the world, telling everybody that they should be democratic. So how democratic are we? And the very interesting thing is, of course, if you apply that to other ideas, that you become a proselytizer when you don't practice what you preach. So, and for our special events, we have on September 19th, along with the Science and Technology Forum again, we have Jeff Marcy and Dan Wertheimer, two top UC Berkeley astronomers, coming to have a debate with each other. The great debate, are we alone? Jeff Marcy is the scientist that came up when he was a PhD student with the mathematics that were required to figure out whether planets were inhabitable or not, or whether there were inhabitable planets circling stars. And about 15 years after he devised the methodology and put it to use, they found the first planets in the 1990s. And so he's going to be speaking. He debates with Dan Wertheimer, who runs the SETI project at UC Berkeley, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. So those two are going to have, obviously, an interesting debate. And on September 20th, we have Jonathan Kanick, a neuropsychologist, who is talking about aging and the persistence of mind. And we have plenty of more things. You can pick up a copy of all of our upcoming events out in front. And now, the time to tell everybody to turn off these little devices that interrupt everybody, including, I always mention it to the speaker, because I find that between me and the speaker, chances that one of us is the one who would offend are about 50%. So, now we'll officially start. And for those of you who are new, we do this double start so that the recordings can go to the second one and immediately, take the recording off of that and skip all of these notices. Any questions before we start? Good. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chair of the Humanities Forum, which together with the Science and Technology Forum, the Environmental and Natural Resources Forum, and the Business and Leadership Forum, organized today's event. We are very pleased tonight to have with us Dr. Hamet from the Scripps Institute, the director of the Scripps Institute, to talk about oceanography and its connection with business.
Well, thank you, everybody. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me. Scripps Institution of Oceanography shares a birthday with the Commonwealth Club. We're both founded in 1903 and coming up to be 110 years old. In our case, the advantage of being 110 years old is on the screen. That's the view from the director's office in La Jolla. You have the advantage of having this wonderful series of talks, and thank you very much for coming to this one. There's a lot of competition tonight. I guess I should just be thankful 6 days ago I would have been up against Clint Eastwood. Now, and there is more wine outside, so if the talk gets a little dull, feel free to go out and... So we're going to talk about oceans, and oceans are important to us. They cover about 71% of the Earth's surface. Everybody owns them and nobody owns them. We use them for protein. About 1 billion people in the world rely on fish as basically their sole source of protein. And you and I have the option of having quite wonderful seafood, although in the U.S. 85% of it is imported, which is another story for another time. We obviously use oceans for transport. 90% of the goods moved around the world are moved by ship, not by truck or airplanes. We lay our internet cables on the bottom of the ocean. Most internet traffic goes via optical fiber, not via satellites. And, of course, we use oceans for inspiration. When we come to the ocean edge, wherever we live, we don't turn around and look at the land mass. We stand in front of the ocean and draw inspiration and beauty from it. We've been abusing the oceans for quite a few decades now. We dump our sewage and our wastewater and our endocrine disruptors into the ocean. About a third of our fisheries are classified as fully fished or overfished. That's sort of scientists speak for fisheries where we take too many fish out, don't allow them to grow and prosper. And about 90% of the heat that we've generated is extra heat we've generated as human beings over the last 150 years has mercifully gone into the ocean, but that has its own side effects. And we're steadily figuring out that about a third of the carbon dioxide that we've made has dissolved in the ocean, which is in fact why my very famous predecessor, Roger Revelle, started hiring people to measure CO2. He thought maybe the oceans would save us. He knew thermodynamics, and he knew that eventually the carbon dioxide that's dissolved in the ocean would mineralize and fall to the bottom of the ocean as various salts. Unfortunately, the thermodynamics is the easy part. The kinetics is always the hard part, and while that's true, it'll take 10,000 years for that to happen, and that's not going to be soon enough to save our grandkids. So we've been dumping a lot of stuff into the ocean, and it's sort of a crisis of the tragedy of the commons. We have the same trouble with the atmosphere, although we've done a little bit better coming up with treaties and organizations to manage the atmosphere. And as you've probably noticed over the last few years, since what we call the global financial crisis, and my friends in China call the North American European crisis, governments all over the world, not just our government, have started to pull back on even the most obvious scientific investments. And one of the candidates in the current election, one of the vice presidential candidates, has a plan to cut all of the science agencies by 40%, cut NSF and NOAA and everybody. And, you know, from where I sit as a Australian visiting your great country, you know, there's about a 50% chance that's going to happen. So I thought I might explain to you how it is we're going to continue to do science and help our community. even if it turns out that our governments are no longer in a position or no longer willing to support the things that I think have made this country great, and that is investing in engineering and science. So the title of my talk is Understanding the Deep Sea, Oceanography Meets Business. So I need to step back a little bit and tell you about this this experiment. This map represents the positions, the last reported positions of 3,561 little robots that my colleague Russ Davis had a big hand in the design of, which measure the temperature and salinity of the ocean, but not just at the surface, down about the first mile of the ocean. Now, this is a pretty amazing experiment and has totally transformed the way that we think about doing experiments, not only in the ocean but in the atmosphere. So let me take a few minutes to describe why this is a good thing to do. For hundreds of years, scientists have understood that the ocean is the great heat reservoir on planet Earth, that the top 6 feet of the ocean has the same heat capacity as the entire atmosphere. And everybody knows if you live near the ocean, it's a moderator to extreme temperatures. So while you inland, you might get frosts and freezing if you're lucky enough to live near the beach in San Diego, as some of us are. The temperature is moderated. Whoops, I kicked the plug here. Let me just restart things here. So we've known for many hundreds of years that we want to do this, but until very recently, the only way we had to do it was to go out on a ship and take a thermometer and lower it down into the ocean and basically measure the temperature. Well, these days, a research ship costs about $45,000 a day. That's not counting the people that you need to put on board. And even I understand that no taxpayer in their right mind would pay for thousands of ships going out into the ocean and making those measurements, even though, you know, for the basic understanding of the planet, they're one of the most fundamental things we do. After all, we spend a lot of energy measuring temperatures here at the surface of terrestrial Earth. So about 30 years ago, scientists put their mind to figuring out a way to do that more cheaply, more economically, but not twice as cheaply, 2,000 times more cheaply. And to that end, these little robots were invented. And the original version was about 6 feet tall. Now they're quite a bit smaller. They're nothing but a little bladder, like a little submarine that has the ability to change its density so it moves up and down the water column depending on the buoyancy of the robot. And miniaturized inside the top of that robot are various instruments. The original ones had just a thermometer and a way of measuring the salinity, how much salt is in the salt water. And they work like this. You put them in the ocean, they sink to a predetermined depth, usually around a mile, maybe half a mile. You let them drift around for 10 days so they get to a new part of the ocean, but they don't have a propeller, they don't have any propulsion, they move with the ocean currents. And then after 10 days, they wake up and surface. And on the way up, they measure the temperature and salinity profile from where they were all the way to the surface. When they get to the surface, they have a little antenna that you might be able to see, and they send the data back to a computer. It happens to be in La Jolla, California, and from that computer all the way around the world for free. So you can log on to the website here, as I did last night, to see where they were. That's an experiment that's funded by 23 different governments. People like me, my predecessors, got together at first as scientists and said, you know, this experiment is within our reach. If we all got together and each of us wrote to our own government agencies, we might be able to get enough money to build these number of floats. And it's turned out to be an incredibly profound and successful experiment. The design point was actually make 3,000 of these and make enough every year to continue that. I do want to say a little bit about human ingenuity. This was not an experiment designed by a committee or a UN agency or even the National Science Foundation. This was Russ and a couple of his scientific friends getting together and saying, you know, we could actually do this. But the first one of these robots that Russ made was, you know, using batteries from 30 years ago. So it lasted about a week. And, you know, it took a brave person to say, you know, I'm not going to worry about the batteries. I have this sense that I don't know, cell phones are going to be invented, or mobile computers. And there's going to be some clever engineer out there who's going to put his or her life's work into making batteries. So Russ didn't concern himself with batteries, even though everyone else was laughing at him when he dumped the first robot in the ocean. When he started, actually, there wasn't a satellite network. But again, he was one of these people who said, you know, there's going to be telecommunications, and it's going to be in the ocean, in the sky, and I'm going to be able to convince those companies, even if it's the telephone company, that they should give me a little bit of bandwidth so I can send my data back. So I'm not going to worry about, you know, throwing satellites into the sky. What I will worry about is miniaturizing the instruments and getting this bladder to work to change the density using the absolute minimum amount of energy. And so that was refined. Other scientists get involved. 22 other nations get involved. And lo and behold, about 5 years ago, we got 3,000 of these floats. We call them, sometimes we call them robots. They drift around. They cover the world's oceans. You might see there not too many towards the southern hemisphere. That's because they don't work under ice. And in fact, they work better than we thought. So people thought with the batteries we had 5 years ago, these would last about 5 years. In fact, they last a lot longer, and that's why we have more than 3,000. We have quite a few more. One of the students asked me this morning over at Berkeley, you know, do they ever go missing? And it turns out sometimes they do. One of my scientists in Australia noticed that one of the robots was reporting from land, actually reporting from right next to Steve Irwin's crocodile farm in Mooloolaba, Queensland. You probably remember the crazy man Steve Irwin who died in tragic circumstances. And he had a really tacky crocodile farm where they torture crocodiles for tourists, much like SeaWorld. And so this robot was reporting there, and so she said, you know, I'm going on vacation actually that way. Do you want me to drive up and see what's happening? So she pulled up in front of a fisherman's house. He had the robot mounted in a table saw and was about to cut the ends off to make a mailbox. And so she pulled out the cash I'd given her and said, look, I'll pay you $300 for that. It costs about $15,000 to make this robot. So she managed to buy back the Argo float, and it was reconditioned and redeployed. Okay, so what's important about this experiment is, of course, that all the data is dumped on the web for free. So you don't have to be sitting in La Jolla or Concepcion or Qingdao in order to do oceanography. And so there are a whole lot of scientists around the world who are thinking of new and different ways to use this data, and they are. First of all, this is one of the great experiments that could have disproved global warming. So we know that under the global warming hypothesis, we're generating heat, we're trapping gases, and scientists have known for 100 years that this heat should end up in the ocean because it has a great, much greater heat capacity than the atmosphere. So one of the many things that oceanographers wanted to do for a long time is measure the temperature of the top half mile of the ocean and to see whether it's absorbed all that heat. But, of course, with ships, it was such an outrageously expensive experiment that you couldn't even get to talk to a politician about it, let alone imagine putting together the billions of dollars to do it. But with these robots, 2,000 times cheaper, it was able to be done. And lo and behold, the amount of heat measured going into the ocean is exactly what's expected from the amount of greenhouse gas that we have currently in the atmosphere. A woman called Susan Weifels, who used to work for me in Australia, did an even more clever... I mean, that's a sort of obvious experiment. It's one of the reasons why it was built. Of course, if it had disproved global warming, you'd all know about it, right? It'd be a very famous experiment, but I'm probably the first person who's ever talked to you about it. Has anyone heard about the Argo system before? A couple of experts in the audience. So this could have been an earth-shattering experiment, and you know, Russ spent 30 years doing it. And, you know, he's a hero in my mind and for the rest of the oceanographic community. So that means me and my six best friends know who this hero is. Susan Weifels did an even more clever experiment. Susan looked at one of the consequences of the global warming hypothesis, which is that hot air can absorb more water than cold air. So if we really are heating up the planet and the atmosphere, we should be driving the hydrological cycle harder. We should be sucking up more water out of the ocean because the air is warmer and water evaporates, so the air can store more water. That those clouds form and they go over land, and so there should be some way of actually testing whether the hydrological cycle is getting bigger, which would support the hypothesis. And if it wasn't getting bigger, then, you know, it would really cast a big shadow over the hypothesis. So Susan figured out that since these little guys were measuring salinity, that if she looked at all the data over the first 5 years of this experiment, right next to the big rivers like the Amazon, she might be able to see effect. And sure enough, she saw a big widening of the lens of fresh water that comes out of the Amazon. So very important supporting evidence that that hypothesis is correct. Well, if I were giving another talk on global warming, I would go through another 9 or 10 experiments that all could have disproved global warming but didn't. And that's one of the ways that scientists, assign a confidence limit. You hear people say, I'm 90% sure it's correct, I'm 99% sure. That's not a guess. It's based on all these different experiments that turned out not to disprove global warming. And then each one of them is supporting the hypothesis. Okay, so let me skip a little bit through. That's actually the salinity map that Susan and her colleagues worked out. It's a paper from Science Magazine, 27th of April, 2012. I mean, this paper just took my breath away. I knew, Susan was a genius, having been lucky enough to be her chief in Australia. But sometimes people come up with ideas and use data in ways that just takes your breath away, and this was one of them. We're now in the very beginning of a robotic age of exploration of the oceans and indeed the atmosphere, where those robots look positively primitive compared to the kind of things that are being developed right now. On the top right is actually something we call a glider, which is similarly unpowered and just sinks itself and lifts itself up in the water column. But it has wings, and it has the ability to move its instruments forward a little bit on rails inside the torpedo so that as it sinks, it moves forward just because it has wings like a hang glider. And when it gets to about half a mile down, the instrument moves the instruments back on rails and tilts the nose up. You change the buoyancy so it rises again and it goes up, but it still goes forward because it's got the wings. So we routinely send these gliders out 300-400 miles off the coast of California, turn them around, bring them back. In fact, in the Gulf oil spill, we were doing all kinds of things. In this case, the wing becomes, when they get to the surface, we rotate them 90 degrees because the rail, you can move the instruments around, and the flipper becomes the antenna, and it communicates with the Iridium telephone network. So we suck all the data out of it, and then if we want, we can reprogram them to do a different loop, which we had to do in the Gulf oil spill because we didn't know where the heck we were when we first threw them into the water. And there are all different kinds of these robots that are sort of have special uses. So this brings me to the connection with business and more modern times. It became very clear as things went on that we wanted to measure the amount of CO2 that dissolves into the ocean. We've been able to measure an atmosphere for 54 years that the amount of human-caused CO2 has gone up by 40%. So for every 5 molecules of CO2 that were there before, there are 2 more molecules, 40% increase. But we also noticed that a lot of that, and that CO2 doesn't equal the amount of CO2 we make by burning oil and gas and coal. And so some of that CO2 is obviously going somewhere else. It's not escaping out into outer space. So some of it, about a third of it actually, is dissolving into the ocean. So we scientists thought it would be high time that we had one of these networks to measure how CO2 was going to dissolve in the ocean. And so that's one of the ideas that I took to Copenhagen, the infamous Copenhagen climate meeting, to try and build support among my peers and the politicians that support us and indeed fund us, to have a publicly funded worldwide ocean acidity network. And you know, history records that that was a dramatic failure. And while we have a pretty good network up and down the coast of North America, the West Coast, all the way from Baja to British Columbia, it's only because we have a lot of pals who've basically scrimped and used leftover funds in order to build this prototype network. The other thing we wanted to do was, instead of measuring CO2 just at a couple of mountaintops to figure out what the CO2 is doing in the ocean, is doing in the atmosphere, the global average, was to measure it more regionally. So how much CO2 was the LA basin emitting? How much CO2 was Beijing emitting? And it turned out scientists have invented that technology. You just have to combine a few more detectors than we usually deploy. It's quite easy, actually, to measure the concentration of CO2 and methane in the atmosphere these days. You can buy an instrument from just down here in Silicon Valley. I'll give them a plug. I'm not connected with the company, but Picaro is a great little company. Uses cavity ring down spectroscopy, which Dick Zare, a very famous professor at Stanford, popularized for analytical chemistry. If you combine those measurements with basically a weather program, but run backwards, you can figure out where the CO2 has come from that is now hitting your detector and that you're breathing, and also how much of it there is. So my colleagues Ray Weiss and Ralph Keeling had done enough experiments on this together with their former graduate students, again, another six people around the world, to realize that this kind of regional greenhouse gas network was doable. And if you've been sort of following the story both before and after Copenhagen, as soon as the scientific community had convinced a few people that it was a good thing to do to look at how much CO2 we were emitting, immediately the economists jumped on the program, on the problem, and said, you know, what we ought to have is a stock market for CO2. We ought to have, cap and trade, emission trading schemes. And we could have a long discussion about that, which you may want to ask me about. But one thing that we've, I've worked in cap and trade schemes before. In when we try and fix up fisheries, we establish a quota, a maximum quota, and then that quota usually comes down because we're trying to save the fishery. And then you bid one fisher against another to see how you buy the quota, how valuable you think that quota is. And so there's, allegedly such a scheme for bluefin tuna, even though there are a couple of countries that don't seem to obey the quota. There are many of us who've worked in these schemes, over decades. And they sometimes work. They worked very effectively for acid rain, if you've followed that part of the story. But the one thing you have to do if you have a trading scheme is you have to measure what it is you're trading. So if you're going to claim that you emitted a gigaton of carbon dioxide, you better be able to say that you emitted it and it came from the L.A. basin and maybe the port of L.A. and the port of Long Beach. And you better have some pretty good scientific data to back that up. Even more, if you're going to claim some kind of credit for not making a ton of carbon, you better be able to prove that. It's not enough to just say, I didn't burn that fuel, so give me credit. It's a bit like having a standard to measure an ounce of gold and proving it that it's 99.999% pure. None of us would think of, trading gold without some kind of analytical chemistry to back that up. So we thought, this is great. All these economists have taken over this problem. They don't listen to us anymore. But they're going to have to come back to us because they're going to need a New York Stock Exchange for carbon. And we're going to be the guys that are going to measure exactly how much carbon dioxide there is, not in terms of the whole planet, but in terms of region by region, at least country by country. And so I and others went to Copenhagen trying to sell that system. And we had just as much success as we did with the ocean acidity system. Everyone said, oh, boy, that's a great idea, but, the world's not ready for it, or, I'm not sure that I want my country's CO2 to be exposed that way. So we had some preliminary discussions. I'm trying to form the coalition of 24 countries. And then we had this little European North American financial crisis, and suddenly everyone said, well, we don't have time or money to spend on the environment. So that's where we had the idea that we would do this by the business community. There are a lot of companies out there that really want to know. Normally it's me whose phone goes off. And for 4 years I've been saying, Mrs. Giuliani is calling me. Because you may remember when Giuliani was running for president last time, he got a phone call in the middle of a speech, and it was Mrs. Giuliani. Well, it's so obscure, everyone's forgotten about that. So when I say Mrs. Giuliani is calling me, they don't sort of get the reference. So thank you for letting me tell that story one last time. So this is my main point tonight, that the value of the data we're learning about the natural world, whether it's earthquakes or what we're doing to the atmosphere or what's happening in the ocean, has always been valuable, and we've done it through a sort of community-based way. You know, I and all my colleagues and pals have been brought up that, you know, the data wants to be free. We're going to dump it on the web. You know, we're going to put together this network. We're going to work like slaves. Russ is going to stay up every night for 30 years figuring out how to work these things, but then the data is going to go so everybody, you know, all the oceanographers at the University of Oklahoma can get the data for free. That's sort of been the tradition. And suddenly, not only our government, but, you know, the UK and France and Germany and all of our, Russia, all of our partners over the years who've been tremendous supporters in the communal effort to understand what's going on the planet, they all said, oh, we've got this financial crisis, we can't do that. And it wasn't, we can only do the two best ideas, we're not going to do any ideas. Because if you're following the carbon dioxide story, we certainly want to have this regional greenhouse gas network. So that led us to think about the value of this data in a different way. And maybe this data is commercially valuable. And how could it be commercially valuable? Well, if you're a company that understands that CO2 is going to be a problem or already is a problem, your shareholders might be saying, we want proof that you, Duke Energy, are actually reducing your emissions. And while you may say we're burning less fuel, we would actually like some independent verification that you are actually making less CO2. If you live in California, we actually have legislation, AB 32. And if you go back and read it, even though it was written without reference to this kind of technology, it's kind of spooky. It says, you know, we're going to have monitoring to show that we meet these targets by 2020 and 2030 and 2050. And, you know, there's a whole set of language that sort of implies that we have a monitoring system that does this. And so, you know, if it's in legislation and people are going to be held to account, then, you know, surely there's a way to fund that kind of measurement. And, of course, at the end of the rainbow is the SEC of CO2. You know, in the whole history of the Chicago Board of Trade and the New York Stock Exchange, it turns out that traders have always wanted to know more about the integrity of their pork bellies before the government even gets around to it. So we thought, you know, we'll be the Chicago Board of Trade of the 21st century, and we'll set up a privately funded network that will give away a lot of the data, but will somehow recover its costs by selling the data to people who want it. And then a miracle occurred. I ran into the CEO of a company called Earth Networks, a guy called Bob Marshall, who was thinking pretty much the same thing. I hadn't met him before. As far as I know, none of our families had ever interacted. But with sort of 80% overlap, we had arrived at pretty much the same conclusion, that this data was valuable, it was probably important for the way the planet was going, and that there were customers out there who would pay, in this case, a private company for that data. And so that data, that network has been launched. It's being built out. I'll show you a few slides about its progress. Bob was able to go to the board of his company. He actually renamed the company Earth Networks in order to sort of pay homage to the idea that they were, they'd been a weather company. They're actually the people behind Weatherbug, if you know that website. They used to have a really annoying app that got installed on your PC and you could never get rid of. I think those days are gone. But they realized that their existing companies, they're a private weather network. They have more weather stations than the National Weather Service. And they're in the business of forecasting extreme events. They use lightning to figure out when there's going to be thunderstorms and tornadoes. They sell data to agriculture companies on soil moisture and the future of soil moisture, you know, rainfall temperatures. They have a whole bunch of clients, and he realized that a subset of those clients would like to know how much CO2 there is in their county or their state, or maybe draw a virtual ring around all of their power stations and figure out how much greenhouse gas my company's emitting. Maybe I can show my shareholders that year by year we're gradually reducing our pollution. So let me show you that network. I'm going to skip a few slides here since these are just aide de memoire. Here, I don't know why I'm in the middle there, but the two scientists who did the work are on the extremes. Ralph Keeling is actually, unbelievably, the son of Charles David Keeling, the man who first measured CO2. Ralph is, in his own right, a distinguished atmospheric scientist. It's a bit like Michael Jordan's son playing point guard for the Chicago Bulls. That happens very rarely in life. And Ray Weiss measures all the other greenhouse gases that are not CO2. CO2 is kind of special, difficult, only has a quadrupole moment, no dipole moment. It's kind of tough measurement. And so starting with Ralph's dad and continued by Ralph, in addition to, he's actually an expert in measuring the oxygen in the atmosphere. Now, I don't know if you've ever thought about it, but if we've increased the CO2 in the atmosphere by 40%, sort of by conservation of percentage, something's got to be going down. Now, I almost never say this because, you know, when you first hear it, you might think it's something scary, and it's not. It's pretty benign. But the thing that's going down in the atmosphere is oxygen. But there's still going to be plenty of oxygen for us to breathe. One thing I should have told you about the ocean is that it makes about 50% of the oxygen that we breathe. Another reason that we should thank the oceans. But the amount of oxygen is going down, and so Ralph became an expert in measuring that decrease. And so by measuring the CO2 increase and the oxygen decrease, you can figure out amazing things about plant life on planet Earth because of the, you know, movement of matter, the summers and winters, how trees are growing, leaves are falling, decaying, and so on. So you can figure out amazing things about how we're changing the planet by combining that data. That's a story for Ralph to tell another day. Anyway, so there's the so-called Keeling curve, probably the most important result my institution has generated. Has lots of implications. And so what we're talking about here is, rather than getting a global average for that, is actually being able to say region by region what's going on. So the instruments to do that look like this. They're basically mass spectrometers, very fancy mass spectrometers. They're very carefully controlled to correct for humidity and so on. And they take their gas from tall towers so that they're a long way from sort of contamination by humans. But this is the sort of current state of the network. So this is all paid for by a private company. They even pay for some support people in Ralph's lab and Ray's lab. This is the status of the network. The purple ones are ones that are actually deployed and installed. The yellow ones are where they've negotiated with the owner of a tall tower to put their instruments on top. And so all that data comes to a website. This is what a typical tower looks like. And you can actually go to earthnetworks.com and scroll down, and you can see data from a couple of these stations. And the idea is that any of us can go to any of these stations and look instantaneously to see what the CO2 concentration is doing right now. And I think this is an example. I hope it's big enough to see. This is actually the one off the Scripps Pier. If you look at the bottom part of this, the red line is the global average CO2 concentration at the month that we made the measurements, and this is going from 1 o'clock in the afternoon to 11 o'clock at night, I think, or 11 o'clock the next day. And the brown line is actually what's measured by these little Picaro instruments. And you see it's always above the red line. It sort of has to be. But you see there are spikes. And what are these spikes? Well, they actually turn out to correspond to rush hour in people driving around in their automobiles. And by following the weather backwards, you know, we have pretty good weather programs now. You know, the weather's pretty reliable out to 5 days, maybe except in San Francisco. So if you actually run that same program backwards, I mean, I'm not kidding, you actually make time minus time and run the same program, you can figure out where the air has come from that you're breathing right now. And in fact, that's much more accurate than going in the forward direction because you have what the weather was and what the wind speed was, so you can constantly correct those trajectories. So that's done on the fly. It's done pretty easily these days with a computer. And one way of representing that data is shown on the top right there. The more red it is, the more probable it is that the air that's flowing over the detector came from that region. And so by looking at these individual spikes, we can figure out when the air came across the landfill that's next to Scripps at the Miramar airfield. It has a lot of methane in it. We can see when the air is blowing from L.A. because there's a gigantic spike, and especially if it corresponds to the morning or evening rush hour. So it's actually pretty amazing technology, and the company's giving it away. And indeed, the company imagines that they're going to be selling weather reports. They sell weather information. They have a bunch of TV stations around the nation. They're actually going to be selling a CO2 report that might look something like this. So here, this CO2, which is a colorless, odorless, hard-to-detect gas that causes us a lot of trouble. Here, it's colored yellow. And this is almost science. There's a few tweaks in this, so, you know, it's not the cover of nature yet. But this is roughly the kind of instantaneous, if you like, CO2 weather that citizens around the country will be able to see. And anyway, you can see a lot of the time the pollution we make in San Diego gets blown into Tijuana. Kind of an interesting turnaround on a lot of public perception. But there are whole heaps of days when gigantic amounts of pollution, I mean, we measure the CO2 and methane, but in trains, oil, all the gases that we make from automobiles, blows from L.A. onto San Diego. So just from the sort of PR point of view, this is sort of a game changer. Something that's very abstract, measuring CO2 on top of a mountain in Hawaii, suddenly becomes something that links to our everyday life. And there's a potential for feedback there. You know, maybe if I took the bus or the train and a lot of other people did the same, we wouldn't have such big spikes on these days. So how can it be this company is giving away all this data? Well, because the instantaneous data is fun for you and me as citizens, but it's actually not that important scientifically. If you want all the data for the last 6 months and from a whole bunch of these detectors, then you have to go to Earth Networks and buy it. So if you want it for your county or for your state or for your company, then you have to pay money. And that money is enough over time to recoup the cost of these detectors. Just like Susan Weifel's, people are using this data in ways that we never predicted. And one of the most controversial is going to be, I'm giving you a little glimpse into the future, tomorrow's headlines tonight. These are all the fracking wells that have been improved in northern Pennsylvania. Now, not all of them have been drilled yet, but there's a lot of, you know, interesting and righteous public debate about the wisdom or not of doing these things. And one of the questions that a lot of scientists have is, you know, you fracture all this rock. Does any of the gas containing methane, you know, leak out? Do you capture it all? Is it coming up fissures? Does it get into the water supply? A whole heap of questions that, you know, people are working hard to answer. So Bob, the CEO, decided that he would look at the detectors that we have in this network around northern Pennsylvania and east of it to see whether there's extra methane. And boy, is there extra methane. So, you know, this data needs to be checked out, but these spikes correspond to a certain measuring stations downwind of northern Pennsylvania. And so here is, this network was not designed to give the fracking industry a hard time. But now that it's out there and it will be publicly available when we figure out, do all the quality controls and so on, there's a whole extra level of scrutiny that citizens are going to be able to have on the industries that are going on around them. Now, I don't know whether it's going to turn out to be benign or whether this is important or so on, but I show it to you as another one of these examples of, if you go out and deploy fairly cheap detectors, you find out you measure a lot of things that, you didn't guess in the first place. And that's sort of what science is. If you look at the whole history, the great history of this country since 1946, the invention of the internet, the invention of, all kinds of things that we take for granted, the GPS, they were all done for completely different reasons. We were smart enough to invest in basic science and engineering. And, there's a pretty good chance that we're going to be the generation that ends that investment. So we're not going to give up. And so I thought I would just quickly give you a couple more examples where we're able to link up with industry to fund things that in the, quote, good old days we were able to fund through your taxes and make a pretty good case that that was worth that investment into this new era where probably we're not going to get to touch your taxes. Either they're going to be all given back to you or they're going to go somewhere else. I should turn a little bit about the deep sea. This is actually a movie taken almost at the bottom of the ocean. The little thing on the right-hand side there is actually James Cameron, the movie director's submarine. You may have heard that in March, February, he went to the bottom of the ocean. It turns out that my colleague Doug Bartlett had robots that went down with him. And Jim Cameron's a great lover of the ocean, and he actually paid to put very fancy cameras on our robots. So we had cameras filming him, and he had cameras filming us. They're a great footage, I'm told. It's all, proprietary. They're going to make an IMAX movie and repay the cost of Jim paying for our cameras. But this is a little glimpse into that IMAX movie. So there's an example of, deep sea expedition. We're picking up sediments and we're sampling microorganisms. We've got stereo cameras in case there's any weird organisms down there. Again, that's the kind of thing that I grew up thinking that would be easy to get a government to fund, and it's not these days. But we're able to work with billionaires who have their own scientific curiosity and do some pretty good science without impacting your taxes. Here's actually the view that Cameron sees when he's looking out in the deep ocean, and he's coming across to some of the robots that we have. Actually, apparently what he sits in front of is a gigantic IMAX camera. He actually doesn't sort of look at the porthole. That's the other pilot. That's a guy called Ron Allum who is the less famous pilot that sometimes... It's a one-person submarine, but sometimes Ron was the pilot. Let's see here. So this is what one of our robots looks like, a bit like some of the other robots I've shown you. So the exploration of the deep sea is just like going to Mars. And I think just like going to Mars, it's going to be robots that collect the data. And as we're seeing now, maybe it's not a government agency like NASA that takes us to this sort of lofty goals of exploration. It'll be like, a patron sending Columbus out to discover the new world. We'll be working for billionaires who think this is a good thing to do and, probably demand less monthly reports than all the government agencies do. Let me move on and show you just a couple of the other companies that we have. Excuse me. Oh, I skipped it this way. Pardon me. It's always a mistake to change your chain of thought. But I do want to show you some of the other ways that we're taking... being able to do more science with less money. So this is a company that we spun off about 2 years ago. It's called MRV. It's basically a company that's able to make those little robots, but make them smaller and more efficiently and sell them to all the other countries that want them. So we had been making them in-house in our machine shop. We're not set up to be a business. So one of our engineers helped us spin this company out. in the Sorrento Valley near La Jolla, California. They've got 11 employees and 8 contractors, and they're selling hundreds of these floats around the world. I mean, you may say it's not much, but it's, you know, 11 jobs in today's economy. Plus, they're able to think about the next generation of machines, maybe commission some scientists to develop some, you know, new miniaturized instruments for them and then put that into their product line. At the same time, we actually spun off a company that I call the Heatwave Company. This is a company called Earth Risk. It's different than Earth Networks. And this is a software company. And one of the founders, Steve Bennett, is there. Steve used to work at Scripps as my deputy in business development. And he liked this idea so much he went out with the company. And what this company does is try to predict what the temperature is going to be about 45 days or 60 days from now. So it's not exactly weather. And let me tell you, this is not enough to plan your niece's wedding with, right? It's only accurate 65% of the time. But if you're trading natural gas futures, or if you're a city manager that's trying to figure out, you know, is a snowstorm coming? How much salt do I have to have? How many workers do I have to have ready, you know, over the next month? It turns out these tools are very handy. And so this company is in the location in Hillcrest in the suburb of San Diego. They have a sort of funky single room. It's just like you imagine a software startup company is. They're selling to clients all over the United States and indeed in Europe, and they're about to have a new product release in the fall. And they pay license fees back to the University of California, which funds more research. And actually, it's a very enlightened board. They've made a couple of donations, just philanthropic donations back, because they like the service that they get from our scientists. So this is a sort of a glimpse into a new world that I think we're coming to, where things that we used to think of as community-owned, we can no longer fund. And so it's either doing without the data, and believe me, I think the way we're impacting our planet, we need all the data we can get, or we find other ways, creative ways, to work with the business community, seize the value that's in the data, and find, you know, ways to get free access to scientists to the data they need. So I'm actually quite excited. I'm disappointed that, you know, that we all had to live through the global financial crisis. I'm disappointed about the quality of debate in this country about science. But, you know, it's not the time to cry on our beer. It's the time to roll up our sleeves and find a different way to get the job done. And I think we have some good prospects in front of us. I'll leave it there and try to take your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hyman, for that very interesting talk. And I'd like to remind our audience that are listening to Dr. Hyman at the Commonwealth Club in California, who would like to ask the first question.
Thank you. Thank you for a wonderful talk. I've been fortunate to touch base with Scripps from time to time. I was born in Ocean Beach, California.
You're a lucky person.
Yes, I was very lucky. I used to swim 2 miles out. I don't do that anymore. But anyway, I have two comment/questions. First of all, I'm very happy that you have found a philanthropic way to take the bull by the horns. And I'm very excited because this curtails a pressure, let's say a political pressure on Brazil, to take the money that was given to them for the purchase of all the clear cut of the Amazon, which is environmental suicide, really, and to not so much give the money back, but to see it as an investment. They maybe will come out of a hoarding. They and a lot of other nations may come out of a hoarding consciousness and into an investment consciousness with real returns. So I think that's brilliant. And it takes the gloom off the whole thing for me. It really does.
Glad to hear that.
Secondly, it was pointed out to the public, I think, after the great tsunami recently, that there were only half the planet was dotted with seismic robots to take seismic information. And I assume by now that they addressed the other half of the planet so that they could send predictors to countries about tsunami activity and so on. So I'm curious. I don't think we've had any more or less tectonic activity than we have now. It's just that we know more about it. And what about the methane coming from two tectonic plates that come together? One gets pushed up and then slides down, and the other one slides back. Aren't there gases from the center of the Earth also contributing to what you talked about? Thank you.
Well, wow, we covered a lot of ground there.
I'm interested.
Yeah, you are. So thank you for coming tonight. I mean, first of all, half of what I talked about is philanthropy. That's the James Camerons of the world. But believe me, if Bob heard us saying, describing his work as philanthropy, he'd get in trouble with his board. I mean, he's a cold, hard businessman who survived in this tough business environment for 25 years. He started a weather company, and so it's not philanthropy for him. It's business. He's selling
it's
this.
Business,
right.
But it's a,
yeah. So you get it, but I just...
It's a good faith investment.
I didn't... Exactly.
Yeah.
He realizes that it's going to have societal benefits as well as help his bottom line.
It already
has, according to... Well, you know, I'm talking about his company here in San Francisco. Maybe that's probably good for him. You know, I'm not a great expert about gases in the Earth. I don't think, you know, unfortunately, there are large parts of the world that don't have the kind of seismic protection, the detector protection that we have, you know, for Hawaii, for example. I remember in 2002, one of my scientists in Australia, a guy called Gary Myers, showed me a whole plan for putting tsunami detectors around the Indian Ocean. And, you know, we sent it to the governments, and they came back saying, oh, you guys are just trying to be hysterical. You're trying to get us worried just so you can do more experiments. And then sure enough, the day after Christmas on 2004, we had this horrible tsunami that killed 250,000 people. Now, I don't know whether Gary could have had his network in place by then, but it's something that's always stuck with me, that, you know, I just don't lie down anymore when a politician tells me I'm just doing this for my own data. You know, we have other motivations as well. But it is true. You know, Fukushima was a big shock to a lot of people. You know, it's clearly impacted the nuclear industry all over the world. And, you know, and I'll give you a private comment. This is not a comment from the University of California or Scripps Institution of Oceanography. But private citizen Tony Haymet thinks that, you know, this was a gigantic management failure and will be talked about in business schools for many years. So I think it's a wake-up call to a lot of us. Let's move on.
Okay. Yes, thank you for sharing all of your insights with us tonight. I wanted to draw you a little further on some of the distinctions between sectors and the places where you said there were markets, perhaps even market failures, where people weren't taking into account many of these issues, and where, in your experience, you feel data-driven management regarding climate, weather, and such may be an under-resourced or under-met need. And then secondarily to that, in your experience with governments, whether you've seen any sign that there is a data threshold or such that is enough to convince the majority of a political body that action is warranted, because we have seen rather strong disinterest in data-driven or, as we would call it, rational decision-making in some quarters?
It's a great question. So, you know, I've had been lucky enough to interact with a number of governments around the world, and call me sick, but, you know, I actually like the politicians I've interacted with. You know, I've interacted with both parties in Australia and both parties here. I mean, they all seem very smart people to me, and I know they could have, you know, made an honest living doing something else. You know, to be crude about it, a lot of them are pretty smart, and they could have made a lot more money being, you know, Wall Street bankers or even Collins Street bankers in Melbourne in Australia. So, you know, I guess I'm one of those people who tries to find the good in every problem child. But it is, you know, there is this recent phenomenon that, you know, I think started in the United States and is now expanded to countries like Australia, where there are a subset of people that are not data-driven. And, of course, it's really hard for people like me to know where to start. You know, for a while there, before I got scared of losing my job, you know, I would pose this question: is what experiment could I do for you that would change your mind? Now, you know, if you say that to a scientist or most people, they'll say, well, actually, if you could measure the temperature of the ocean and show me that it's going up, that would change my mind. But, you know, several times in Washington, I got the reply, well, there's actually no experiment you could do. And you know, then you realize it's my turn to be polite and excuse myself and get the heck out of there. So, you know, in my lifetime, that's a relatively recent thing. You know, I've been able to go to ministers and secretaries and say, you know, here's a data set. We ought to do this. I mean, my colleague Dan Kane has collected data on the snowpack in California. And so, you know, we see in California that while the precipitation is only going down slowly, we're getting much more rain and less snow. I mean, that's a horrible problem for us because we've been blessed for 150 years. The Sierras have stored our water for us for free, and it melts at exactly the right time when we need it for our agriculture. And it's just horrible to think that, you know, we're not going to have that free storage anymore. First of all, it's all going to come down as a rush. You know, we couldn't possibly build enough dams now to catch it. It's going to do a lot of damage as it gouges through these creeks and river systems. And we're not going to have our, you know, agricultural and urban water supplies. Well, you know, I've had great success taking Dan's data and showing it to all kinds of people. And they sort of get it, you know, especially when it's something as close to you as drinking water. But you're right. We're in a very, I think, unusual era. And it's kind of weird for someone who's come to love this country like me where, you know, the whole of the wealth and prosperity of the United States is based on, you know, the National Academy of Science figuring out things, taking us to the moon and, you know, figuring out how to deal with the problems we have, whether it's in agriculture or water supplies or disease. You know, it's all data-based. You know, all the National Institutes of Health and so on. And so when you run into a group of people who sort of turn their back on the greatest prosperity ever generated on planet Earth from science and technology and a willingness to take data, and it might even shake to the core your very personal beliefs, but if the data shows that you're wrong, you accept it and move on and go on to the next challenge. It's difficult to encounter a subset of people who just don't think like that and don't even recognize that their very prosperity has been generated from these scientists and engineers who cured disease and found how to make water all over the United States and figured out more efficient crops so we could all have enough to eat. You know, I hope it's a transitory period, but who knows? I hope we all live long enough to see what happens.
So I had a slightly different take than the first question, commenter. My take-home feeling from what you've been telling us I have more concern, and I'm just wondering if you can validate whether my concern is warranted. I understand you are telling us that research is becoming privatized, which we've certainly seen, and you know, as federal and state dollars have disappeared, that research is being funded by the private sector. Mm-hmm. We certainly see that with university-based research. We're here in California, Dow is funding much of the research going on at UC Berkeley, and sustainability is being defined by private corporation funding of our research agenda at universities. So I definitely see that happening. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm wondering in your field and what you're seeing, where the private sector is picking up where public funding leaves off. Does that change what type of research is being funded? Does it mean that research that might serve the public interest and might serve the public's needs is getting short shrift and not quite as well prioritized as the research that funds that is being funded by private enterprise?
It's a great question, and the short answer is yes. There's certainly the possibility that that's happening. And so, for example, in the Earth Networks case, I spent a lot of time negotiating the contracts that we would help them. You know, they really needed us to be the credible quality control on their instruments. I mean, they didn't really know what to buy before Ray and Ralph told them. But we negotiated a really rigorous contract. So, you know, any professor around the world could get a free license in perpetuity to their data. But, you know, if they're bought by a Chinese concern, is there a chance that that data might disappear? I have to say to you, yes. So people like me are faced with the question of never having the data because, I'm going to be long gone before governments get around to building this private network, at least at the rate that I was going starting from Copenhagen. Or, do we take the data and assume the risk and try to figure out ways of minimizing that risk? So there's incredible dangers of privatizing anything. But, don't think too badly of me. I mean, I'd like to think of my scientists who do that kind of work as Mozart, You got to make a living. You got to support your family. And if it's some prince or, the Count of Venice or whatever that's supporting you so you can write symphonies and great music, then what's the problem? Human beings have done that pretty much the whole time up until, really 1946. If you look at the great English scientists and the people who discovered gases, they were all incredibly wealthy people that made their fortune off the back of serfs toiling in the fields, but they sort of had a benevolent side. Instead of playing billiards in Las Vegas, they figured out how to do science, and discovered CO2 and argon and so on. So, I think you sort of have to take the long view of science. There's always been patrons in science, except for this great system that the United States really invented with the Office of Naval Research and spinning off NSF, and that's why people like me are here. That's why the U.S. became the magnet for science, because you knew if you had a good idea, someone would look at it and either tell you, no, that's not a good idea, or they say, that could be a good idea. Here's, $23,000, Tony, and go away and figure that out. So I think there is a risk that the most successful and public-minded system that anybody's ever invented, namely the U.S. between 1946 and 2008, might be disappearing. And I lament that. I'm obviously a product of that, and I think it's self-evident that it's a fantastic system. With all its imperfections, it's the best system that was ever invented. And you're right, it might be going away, and we may be headed back towards more of a patron-based system where Bill Gates, is the only guy supporting malaria research, and Jim Cameron is supporting deep sea research, and Prince Albert is, paying for us to study microbes. Well, all of those things are true right now, and I think one just has to roll up your sleeves and get on with it. But I think you're right to be concerned about it. I don't know that we're going to have it within our power to convince today's politicians that the 60 years that they're turning their back on is actually a pretty good way to do things.
We have time for one more question.
That was really a cautionary but optimistic talk. The CO2, is it stimulating greater photosynthesis? Are the forests fixing more carbon, the phytoplankton, the grasslands? Are they getting greener? Is all that being measured? Because I guess that's where it all ultimately goes back.
Yeah. About 57% of the CO2 has been going into the atmosphere. We know that because fuel is expensive, you can actually count it, right? So we know exactly how much fuel is burnt every year. And that curve that I showed you, if you put a line through it, is exactly 57% of that and has been that way for five decades. The other part of it goes between two sinks, we think. One of them is the ocean. About another third of that goes in the ocean. But it looks like the The rest of it is going into reforestation in certain places in the world, mostly in Siberia and to some extent in New England and northeastern Canada. And so one of the reasons why Ralph Keeling's work is so important is that by measuring the, you know, if the CO2 goes into the ocean and the CO2 goes into plants, that has a different effect on the oxygen concentration. You can probably see how that works out. So if you know both those numbers very precisely, you can actually figure out how much is going into the forests and how much is going into oceans. You had me there a little bit worried there. I thought you were going to say, you know, CO2 is plant food. But, of course, you know, all plants need CO2, as President Reagan taught us. And there are places in the world, you know, seagrasses, there are some organisms in the ocean that are going to do better with this 30% increase of the hydrogen ion concentration. And we measure that. If you actually go to places in the ocean where there are methane seeps, you find the seagrasses that are growing around them are growing like crazy. You know, they're growing like Iowa cornfields. But what we understand is that because one species does better doesn't mean that there are tens of thousands of species that do worse. And unfortunately, that's the way it's going to turn out in the ocean.
Well, there's one last optimistic note, at least from a 9-year-old boy's point of view. I heard him talk about global warming and how fast it was going to happen and the carbon dioxide going back into the plants. And he said, does that mean the dinosaurs will come back when everything heats up? Well, thank you very much, Dr. Hammett, for a great talk. And that signs another discussion, enlightened discussion at the Commonwealth Club of California in its 110th year of enlightened discussion.